From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, how an American journalist found herself caught in a web of spies, terrorists, and covert operations. We'll talk with Martha Honey. Her husband, journalist Tony Avergan, was nearly killed in 1984 by a bomb planted at a press conference held by Contra leader Eden Pastora. The couple spent the next decade investigating who planted the bomb. Also today, we talk with Gerald Early, director of African American Studies at Washington University. His new memoir is about raising his daughters in a predominantly white suburb. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews David Byrne's latest album. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Former President Jimmy Carter says that North Korea has changed its mind and will now let United Nations weapons inspectors stay in the country.
When I arrived here, the North Koreans told me that they were going to expel the inspectors within 2 days, but they have reversed that point. So long as good faith efforts are being made jointly between the United States and North Korea.
Carter spoke earlier today with CNN. He indicates the breakthrough could signal an end to the nuclear crisis on the Korean Peninsula. The United States has been pressuring the North to open its nuclear sites to inspection, and it has proposed sanctions as a way to force the North to comply. Democratic congressional leaders have introduced legislation to link human rights conditions to China's trading status with the United States. The bill would revoke most favored nation trading status for Chinese products. President Clinton has already renewed MFN status for Chinese exports. He imposed minor sanctions against Chinese-made guns and ammunition, but he broke the link between trade and human rights that he set a year earlier. It's not clear if today's legislation will pass. Mr. Clinton arrives in Chicago today for a 2-day visit. He'll campaign for a Democratic candidate while he's there. He and the First Lady will also attend the opening of the World Cup soccer tournament, NPR Cheryl Duvall reports.
The president is speaking at a fundraiser for Democratic gubernatorial nominee Dawn Clark Netsch. She's the Illinois state controller, challenging Republican incumbent Governor Jim Edgar. Clinton visits as the race is heating up. 5 months before the election, Edgar's campaign has begun broadcasting television ads portraying liberal Netsch as soft on crime. Tomorrow morning, President Clinton visits the Robert Taylor Public Housing Development to talk with residents there about his plans for welfare reform. He'll then go to Soldier Field, where, with German Chancellor Helmut Kohl, President Gonzalo Sanchez de Lozada of Bolivia, and other dignitaries, he will watch the World Cup opening ceremonies and the tournament's first game between Germany and Bolivia. In Chicago, I'm Cheryl Duvall reporting.
OPEC has promised to keep oil production at its current limit this fall and winter. The oil cartel is trying to keep crude prices on their upward climb. The oil production ceiling is now at 24.5 million barrels per day. The average price of crude oil has increased to $16 a barrel since March. That's up about $3 per barrel. Analysts say the other reason for higher prices is the improved economies of the United States and Japan, which use large quantities of crude oil to run their factories. And OPEC predicts that demand for more crude oil will go up this fall and winter with colder weather. On Wall Street, the Dow is up 16 points at 3,800.06. Trading is heavy. The Nasdaq is down a point at 734. This is NPR. A new report says countries are spending less on their military forces. The Stockholm International Peace Research Institute says military spending and arms trading fell last year for the 8th year in a row. But the report adds there are still 34 armed conflicts going on. That's one more than last year. The Institute says the U.S. sold almost half of the conventional arms on the market. Russia accounted for 21%. The Stockholm Institute adds that China also seems to be strengthening its armed forces. Italy's prime minister meets with German Chancellor Helmut Kohl today in Germany. Italian leader Silvio Berlusconi's visit is his first state trip abroad. NPR's Deidre Berger reports from Frankfurt.
After a meeting between Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi and German Chancellor Helmut Kohl, both leaders emphasized cooperation between their countries. The two conservative politicians said they hope to bring former Warsaw Bloc countries as quickly as possible into the European Union. Kohl told Berlusconi he had assumed responsibility at an important historic moment. He did not mention Berlusconi's neo-fascist coalition partners. The Italian prime minister defended his government, claiming that intolerance, war, and anti-Semitism belonged to the past. He guaranteed the democratic basis of his government. In an interview with a German tabloid newspaper, Berlusconi said there are no neo-fascists in his cabinet, only ministers who are committed to democracy. I'm Dieter Berger in Frankfurt.
Negotiators for the Long Island Railroad and its union are still talking. Union workers have pushed back a strike by one day, although trains were sidetracked for about 3.5 hours overnight. The new strike deadline will take effect this evening at midnight. The United Transport Union has worked without a contract for 2.5 years. There's been no raise since 1990. The rail company is pointing out that the union members are among the most highly paid in the nation. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Martha Honey is trying to untangle herself from the network of conspiracies and covert operations that swallowed up a decade of her life. In 1984, she and her husband, Tony Avergan, were both freelance journalists based in Costa Rica, covering the conflicts in Central America. In 1984, they were focusing on Nicaragua and the Contra forces that were trying to overthrow the Sandinista government. On May 30, 1984, Contra commander Eden Pastora held a press conference in his camp. He was backed by the CIA, and he was going to announce that the agency had issued an ultimatum he refused to carry out. Tony Avergan went to the press conference. The conference was cut short by a bomb explosion which wounded Pastora. Avergan was one of the journalists who was seriously wounded. Avergan and Honey spent the next decade investigating who planted the bomb. Their investigation intersected with the Iran-Contra affair. As they tried to penetrate secret networks, they found themselves accused of drug trafficking, bribing witnesses, and espionage. Martha Honey has written a new book called Hostile Acts. She told me about the day the press conference was bombed. She was at home.
Well, the reason I stayed home was that I was writing a story, which actually appeared front page of the New York Times the next day, and I was able to stay home because we had been following very closely what was going on inside the Contra movement based in Costa Rica. That's the anti-Sandinista rebels fighting covertly out of Costa Rica in the early 80s. And what we knew was going to happen at the press conference was that the main Contra leader, Eden Pastora, was going to announce that he'd been under extreme pressure from the CIA to unify his movement with the CIA-controlled and run large Contra army known as the FDN, which was fighting out of Honduras. And Pastora planned to use that press conference to denounce CIA pressure and to say that he was going to basically cut his ties with the CIA and continue fighting sort of a rebel on his own against the Sandinistas.
So what happened to the press conference?
Well, about 24 journalists from numerous countries traveled from Costa Rica up to the press conference. It was being held at a very remote Contra camp about 3 feet inside Nicaraguan territory, a place called La Panca. And 20 minutes into the press conference, as Pastora was just beginning his diatribes against the CIA, a powerful bomb exploded in the midst of the press. Three journalists died there on the spot, and about a half dozen Contras. And virtually almost all the press was injured, including my husband, Tony.
You write in your new book, Hostile Acts, that you began with the assumption that the bombing could have been the work of the left or the right. What would the motivations have been on each side?
Yes, actually, today, we now believe that there were sort of three streams which converged, three groups of plotters that converged in some way that we don't fully understand at La Panca. One was, of course, the CIA, and in many ways that was probably the most obvious because we knew that Pastora was under enormous pressure from the CIA and had called the press conference specifically to denounce this pressure. The CIA had armed and financed and trained Pastora's troops, as they had all of the Contra forces. But it had always been a rocky relationship because Pastora, although he was anti-communist, was also a very strong nationalist. And he basically wanted to take CIA training and supplies but run his own war. And the CIA didn't like that and they didn't trust him politically. They called him the 10th Comandante, a covert member, a secret member of the Sandinista Directorate. And they had basically determined that they were going to get rid of him. all of our early leads pointed towards the CIA, or more specifically towards the Oliver North network. We found, for instance, that Oliver North had made a covert trip to Costa Rica just 3 days before the bombing, that his chief aide, Robert Owen, was in Costa Rica at the time of the bombing, that a North American farmer who was really a CIA operative, John Hull, and a group of Cuban Americans out of Miami seemed to be deeply involved in plotting against Pastora. And we also found that after the bombing, there was a very sophisticated cover-up that put out a whole series of false leads, and these leads again and again named the wrong terrorist group, pointed towards the Sandinistas, but named the wrong terrorist group and the wrong bomber, and sent us and other journalists on enormous wild goose chases around Europe and Latin America searching for the wrong person. All of these leads came from the U.S. government.
But you also thought that the bomber could be from the extreme left.
We did, because clearly the Sandinistas also had reasons to hate Pastora. Pastora had been a Sandinista, had fought, been the leader of the Southern Front forces fighting against the Somoza dictatorship, had been a member of the government in the Ministry of Interior and Defense in the first year after the Sandinista triumph. And he split with the Sandinistas, and he had quite extensive popular following in Nicaragua. So there were clearly people in the leadership in Nicaragua who deeply distrusted him, considered him a traitor to their cause, and in particular, Thomas Borge in the Interior Ministry. So we indeed believed right from day one that the Sandinistas also had a motive. The problem was that all the leads pointing to the Sandinistas for years didn't check out. And I just wanted to mention that the third stream, which we also began to uncover evidence of, was that of the drug cartels, that drug traffickers, which included some of the people, John Hull and some of the people working for the CIA. But the drug cartels were hoping to use the Contra forces, were indeed using the Contra forces and the Contra airstrips and so on as one of the avenues for moving drugs from Colombia into the U.S. And they wanted to expand their operations through the Contra bases in Costa Rica, and Pastora was blocking that. He was saying no to his pilots and to other people who wanted to expand the drug trafficking through Costa Rica. So the cartel and some of the people working for the cartel in Costa Rica as well had a motive for killing Pastora.
As you got involved in the investigation, you started to learn more about America's covert support of the Contras. Were you onto the story before the Iran-Contra story broke?
Yes, we were. As I think, you know, I don't want to say that we were the only ones. Obviously, there were a number of journalists in Central America. In fact, in many ways, the Contra war was kind of lying there, waiting to be picked up and reported on. But we had been following, since our arrival in Costa Rica in 83, we had been following very, very closely Eden Pastora's operations, and really knew that the CIA had a dozen or so people right inside Pastora's organization. We knew where the airdrops were being made. We knew who the CIA collaborators in the Costa Rican government were, what the CIA network in the embassy was, and so on. We were quite well informed and had a number of excellent sources. And after the bombing, began investigating who could have been responsible and basically began unraveling even more this ball of wax that later became Iran-Contra, and began following this trail from the Contra camps and the collaborators in Costa Rica, and eventually finding that it led up to the basement of the White House and Oliver North's office.
Now, you had a lawsuit in which you sued several CIA officials, former CIA officials, U.S. military officers, and arms merchants. And this lawsuit was kind of a conspiracy thing. It basically, correct me if I'm wrong here, but it charged that this group of people had been conspiring over a series of decades, and that this secret team had worked together since the 1950s, planning things ranging from the Bay of Pigs operation to anti-Castro activities. They ran the secret war in Laos, assassinated political opponents in other countries, destabilized Chile. You write in your book that you were actually troubled by this suit and by the way it was pursued. And why were you part of this suit if it was troubling? What troubled you?
Yes, I'm glad you asked this question, because I would like to try to explain. We found ourselves under enormous pressure and risk in Costa Rica. being accused of being spies and receiving death threats at one point. We were mailed a packet of cocaine and accused of being drug traffickers and so on. And we finally decided, because we couldn't get anybody in the U.S. government to really actively investigate the bombing or in the Costa Rican government, that perhaps we could use the power of the U.S. courts to try to, one, get the people who were tormenting us sort of off of our back, kind of put them on notice that we were not going to take this, and also use the court system to try to learn more than we were able to do through interviews and so on, to use the process of discovery and taking depositions and so on to try to gain more information about what was really going on, what the extent of these covert operations were. We talked to, sort of long distance since we were in Costa Rica, made contact with a number of lawyers, and it was only Daniel Sheehan and the Christic Institute who said that they indeed could take the lawsuit, would like to take the lawsuit, would like to handle a lawsuit like this, and they claimed that they had enormous amounts of information already compiled on what they called the secret team, on the people we were looking at and more, other people, a number of whose people whose names we didn't at that point know, and they had not shown up in our investigations in Costa Rica. So we sort of hitched our star to the Christic Institute, and it was, as you mentioned, kind of a troubling relationship right from the beginning, one where we felt particularly clear that our interest was trying to uncover the misdeeds in Central America, what current U.S. policy was involved in Central America. We did agree to go along with the lawsuit, and it was a kind of stormy relationship, and eventually it was thrown out by the courts, and we had enormous sanctions put against the law firm and the attorney Dan Sheehan and ourselves by the court, saying that this was a frivolous lawsuit. We have now, you know, clearly broken with Dan Sheehan. In fact, I've just come back from Los Angeles, where we actually had a trial against him, trying to get the Christic files, the files from the lawsuit, which are supposed to belong to the clients, and we won that trial. And all the files from the lawsuits are being returned to Washington, and we're going to house them at the National Security Archive, where we feel they should properly be housed.
Do you feel that your lawsuit ended up feeding conspiracy theorists?
Well, I think that there is a tendency on the part of certain segments of the U.S. public to believe in conspiracy theories. And certainly we were involved in, there was a conspiracy that plotted the La Panca bombing and plotted other operations in Central America. But I don't believe that it was the same secret team that went back decades and was involved in all the sort of skullduggery of U.S. operations, clandestine operations going back to the Bay of Pigs and perhaps even earlier. So I think that it was unfortunate the way it was crafted as such a sort of, in some ways, concise and also long-term conspiracy, because I think that distorted reality, and that really what we need to see is that these covert operations are always done in a conspiratorial way. There is a group of people who plan them, but that group of people is shifting, and what we really need to focus on are the institutions in our governmental institutions which allow such covert operations and such conspiracies to take place.
My guest is journalist Martha Honey. She and her husband, journalist Tony Avergan, spent a decade investigating who bombed a Contra press conference in which Avergan was seriously injured. Honey has written a new book called Hostile Acts. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back with journalist Martha Honey. In your investigation and lawsuit, you were pursuing the CIA connection to the La Panca bombing. But when the bomber was actually discovered, it turned out he was linked to the Sandinistas, to Cuba, and to some other left-wing groups. Tell us something about him and what those links were.
Yes. Always, all the years until just about, beginning about 2 years ago, The one big missing piece in our puzzle of who was responsible for the Lapenka bombing was the true identity of the bomber. As I mentioned, he had posed as a Danish journalist traveling with a stolen passport and using a false identity. And he had disappeared. He'd been uninjured and had disappeared afterwards. We were given various descriptions of him by people working either with the Contras in Costa Rica or people supporting the Contras in Miami. And we were told that he was an Arab or perhaps Jewish, that he was from the Middle East, and that he spoke Spanish with a South American accent. But we never knew for sure who this man was. And it was finally last summer that a number of bits of information came together to conclusively identify this guy through fingerprints, through identification from his family, and through identification from his former sort of comrades in arms, that he was someone named Vital Roberto Gaguin, who was a leftist Argentine who had fought with one of the Argentine left-wing groups and had come up to Nicaragua after the triumph and had been integrated into Nicaragua's security apparatus, Ministry of Interior, into a very secret unit, which was known as the Fifth Directorate, headed by a Cuban and ultimately headed by Thomas Borges, the Minister of the Interior. And that the function of this unit, which was made up of a group of Argentine leftists and other people from Basque separatists, from ETA and various other leftist nationalities from around the world, the function of this sort of international group was assassinations, terrorism, spying, all the sorts of operations that we had uncovered in Costa Rica that the CIA was involved in with their network that was headed by John Hull and Cuban Americans. So it was kind of the flip side of the Ali North network that we found in Costa Rica indeed existed within the Sandinista apparatus, specifically within the Ministry of the Interior. And that this fellow, Gaguin, was working for this unit and that he came to Costa Rica, hooked up with a Swedish journalist who was himself a sort of spy for the Sandinistas in Cuba, and that he carried the bomb to the press conference.
Now, how did you feel when you found out that the bomber was actually not with the CIA, but with the Sandinistas?
Well, it was an enormous shock. As I said earlier, all of the leads that we had had, and there were a dozen or more very concrete leads that had pointed towards the Sandinistas, and we had investigated all of them thoroughly. Every one of them had fallen apart. It had not been true. We had been told that he was a leftist Uruguayan working for the Sandinistas, that he was a PLO guy connected to the Sandinistas, on and on and on. All of these leads had fallen apart. And as I said, also, we had this enormous body of evidence which linked the CIA and the Oliver North Network not only into the bombing but into the cover-up afterwards. So this came as a real shock to us, but we are convinced that it's true, that indeed this was the bomber. Now, the question that we're left with is why, if this was a pure Sandinista action, why was it that the U.S. government put out one phony lead after another all these years? It could be incompetence. But we also now know that the CIA had intelligence operatives working deep inside Sandinista's Ministry of the Interior, as well as deep within Pastora's organization. So it seems to us unlikely that they were not aware of really what happened, who was responsible. And so the question is, why didn't they put out this information, which would have been a real political coup for the Reagan administration, because the Reagan administration was saying as loud as they could that the Sandinistas were terrorists, that they were committing human rights violations. And what better way to prove that than to show that they were killing innocent journalists? What we're left with is the suspicion that somehow this bombing was convenient and perhaps was organized by both the CIA and the Sandinistas Interior Ministry officials, that it was something that was either organized by one and known about by the other and they decided to let it happen, or in fact that both sides had a hand in it, as well as, we believe, the drug cartels, that they also had a hand in it. We we feel convinced, and we've talked with, you know, sort of the best minds that we can find in terms of people who understand the intelligence community and counterterrorism and so on, that that probably the CIA didn't disclose the truth because it would have compromised some of their, one or more of their deep cover operatives, and that they didn't want to take that chance.
Do you ever feel that you're in quicksand, and the deeper you get, the deeper in you sink, the more difficult it is to get out?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I now feel that we may never know the truth, that it's probably going to take somebody coming forward and just saying, look, this is really how it was, and laying it out. And that person may never come forward.
Do you have friends who have tried to convince you, give up, go on with your life, drop it, get back to your journalism career?
Yes.
Because you're never going to find out what really happened, and people are going to think that you're crazy.
Yeah, I mean, certainly. And I think that, you know, that some of those suggestions, particularly a decade afterwards, are sensible. And that, you know, in a sense, my doing this book, Hostile Acts, was, at least for me, sort of a psychological finishing of that part of our lives. I mean, a way of kind of putting it down on paper and trying now, in many ways, yes, we are moving on. We've moved from Costa Rica. We're living in Washington, and we're involved in a whole host of other projects. But this continues to gnaw at us, and we continue to, you know, when we can, and when new leads turn up, to follow them. And we are doing that, you know, on a regular basis.
I've spoken to a lot of people over the years, journalists who have covered covert operations and, you know, government intelligence groups and stuff, and they get into that whole hall of mirrors. But they're doing it as journalists. They're not players in the story, if you know what I mean.
Yes.
Now, you've become kind of trapped in this hall of mirrors because in trying to investigate it, and since your husband was one of the people who was injured in the bombing, you've become so entwined in the story, and I wonder, what does it do to your mind to be in the middle of this hall of mirrors where there are agents and maybe counter-agents and maybe three different sets of covert operations working, and you can't sort things out, and 10 years later questions still remain unanswered. Does it turn you paranoid? Is it hard to trust anybody after this? I just wonder what it's, mm-hmm. what it does to you psychologically.
Yeah, I think obviously psychologically it's not been very good for us. And I, as I said, one of the reasons that I wanted to write the book was kind of a catharsis to sort of get it out. This is an unusual circumstance because it was a terrorist act that took place at a press conference. And so instantly we became not only victims but also investigators. And we've always had this dual role, and it is troubling. I don't think, fortunately, I don't think we've gotten to the point where we're suspicious of everybody. We do feel, and we're not sure who it is, we feel obviously we've been fed some bad information over the years. We know some of those sources, but we're now trying to sort of go back through sources and say, now who could have lied to us? Because clearly some of the things we were told were just not true.
Martha Honey, thank you very much for talking
with us. Thank
you,
Terry. Thanks.
Martha Honey is the author of the new book, Hostile Acts. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Writer Gerald Early grew up poor in the inner city. Now he's raising his two daughters in a middle-class, predominantly white suburb. Coming up, we talk with Early about the difficulties and dilemmas of translating his own experience of racism to his daughters. Early is director of African American Studies at Washington University. He's written a new memoir about fatherhood. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the latest album by David Byrne. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. North Korea has dropped its threat to expel the international inspectors now monitoring the country's nuclear program, according to former President Jimmy Carter. Mr. Carter is in Pyongyang as a private citizen, but he's been meeting with the North Korean leaders. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
If the inspectors are allowed to stay, the outside world will be able to learn whether North Korea is diverting any more nuclear fuel to an atomic weapons program. The North has already diverted enough for one or two bombs. The presence of inspectors could discourage Pyongyang from building any more. Mr. Carter told Cable News Network the inspectors will be allowed to stay as long as good faith efforts are made by the U.S. and North Korea to resolve the nuclear dispute.
President Kim Il-sung has committed himself to maintain the inspectors on site and also to guarantee that the surveillance equipment would stay in good operating order.
North Korean officials have been saying since last Friday the inspectors would have to leave. If they can now stay, it represents a major and very public reversal of North Korean policy. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
Meanwhile, the Russian foreign minister is angry with the United States over its handling of possible sanctions against North Korea. Andrei Kozarev says the Clinton administration has violated an agreement to consult with Moscow before proposing such sanctions. The minister says Washington's failure to do this will seriously hurt the work of the United Nations Security Council. The White House is strongly denying Kozarev's charge. Officials say President Clinton and Secretary of State Warren Christopher have consulted with the Russians, and the dialogue is continuing. The government says housing starts have rebounded despite higher mortgage rates. They were up last month by 2.6%. Walter Maloney of the National Association of Realtors says the bad weather from earlier this year delayed construction in many areas for a while.
We're having kind of a surge of sales taking place now. This level, though, it's very, very good. It isn't going to be able to be sustained at this level. It will come down in the future. Even so, we're looking for total housing starts this year to be about 1.4 million. That is a very good number and would work out to about a 9% increase over last year.
Applications for building permits fell by 1.6%. This could signal slower construction ahead. The United States is pulling most of its embassy personnel out of Haiti. Some 100 out of 175 people are scheduled to leave Haiti by Saturday. They're departing before a cutoff of air service from Haiti to the United States. That takes effect June 24th. It's part of stricter new sanctions against the ruling military government. Stock prices rallied today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrials gained 21 points to close at 3,811. Advances led declines by a small margin in heavy trading. This is NPR. Both sides in the Rwandan civil war have promised to stop shooting, but words are as far as they've gotten. Rebels fired machine guns and mortar shells at government positions today in a new effort to take over Kigali, the capital. The advancing rebels control most of the north and east of Rwanda. They've surrounded government troops in the Kigali city center. A ceasefire was reached in Tunisia on Tuesday, but there's no indication that the frontline troops have heard of it. Peace talks set for today have also been delayed by a day. The reason is not known. Nearly 4 million indigenous people in Ecuador are demonstrating to protest a new law that they say will reverse 25 years of land reform. Ray Collett reports from Quito.
Ecuador's indigenous population is going into its third day of increasingly violent protests against a controversial land reform law passed on Monday. Roadblocks in the central Andean provinces have already resulted in riots and food shortages elsewhere. Indians armed only with machetes and clubs suffered their first fatality earlier today when a motorist attempting to break through a barricade shot a protesting Indian. While supporters of the law say it strengthens property rights and paves the way for increased production, Indian leaders say it denies them communal land and water rights. No immediate solution is in sight, as the government is not willing to negotiate, and indigenous leaders say they will continue protesting until the law has been annulled. For National Public Radio, I'm Ray Collett in Quito, Ecuador.
The Pentagon is defending the amount of money it spent on D-Day anniversary celebrations. Republican Congressman Dan Burton has been complaining about the size and cost of the Clinton administration's D-Day delegation. He suggests the air travel bill to France could be larger than $6 million. But Burton's proposal to cut millions of dollars from the White House budget for refusing to provide full information on D-Day spending was defeated last night by the House. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Just in time for Father's Day, Gerald Early has a new memoir about family and fatherhood called Daughters. Early is the director of African American Studies at Washington University. He and his wife, Ida, are raising their two girls in a predominantly white suburb of St. Louis. Early's daughters are growing up in a world totally unlike the one he grew up in. When he was a boy, his family was poor and lived in the inner city of Philadelphia. The difference between those two worlds has created a lot of dilemmas for Early in bringing up his children.
I think the biggest dilemma is they don't really understand my experience or how I grew up. Mm-hmm. And they find it pretty foreign. They also find the people I grew up with to be pretty foreign. They find the neighborhood I grew up in to be pretty foreign. So foreign that they can't really understand how all of that and these people produced the man they know as their father. And I think that's the biggest thing. And I guess the thing I wanted to try to get across in the book was trying, in fact, to get them to the point of understanding that and to the point where they finally became interested themselves in wanting to know about the little boy who became their father.
Your daughters growing up in the suburb, I mean, they want certain comforts. There was a period when they were both daughters were fighting about having to share the same bathroom. They each thought the other was a slob. So they wanted two bathrooms. Now, did you resent it when your daughters start to demand two bathrooms because you grew up poor?
Yeah, I did resent it. I mean, I resent their kind of material presumptions. Part of that is a carryover from my own childhood. And I think that all of us bring burdens from our own childhood with us into our adulthood. We bring these burdens into our parenting. I don't think we can help it. I think we can try to do things to try to deal with it, but I don't think we can help bringing those things with us. And so I wind up at times resenting, as in the case with the bathrooms, my daughter's attitudes about certain things. And it has nothing to do with them. They're totally innocent. I mean, they're just responding to their own experience and what they know. And it's all the baggage that I'm bringing with me from my own childhood and thinking that there is great virtue in deprivation, which is totally not true, but which I like to think is true.
It's hard to raise kids in the suburbs and then tell them that there's great virtue in deprivation.
There's a discipline in there. I like to tell, I use the word discipline all the time, and it doesn't seem to sink in. And it's a myth, and they're bright enough to kind of know that, and they're bright enough to know that I'm bringing on certain kind of baggage to them, and they rightly reject it.
Your 14-year-old daughter, your older daughter, Lynette, is learning disabled, mm-hmm. which you didn't know until she was in school for a couple of years.
Right.
And so you at first thought that she was just slow, that she wasn't as smart as you'd hoped she would be. What was your reaction to her performance in school before you realized that she actually had a problem?
Enormous frustration. Both my wife and I experienced enormous frustration. And so we each played out a certain kind of drama. I think Lynette may have gotten some benefit from it, but I think at the time she probably didn't. Where we were bringing, once again, our own set of associations that we had with school and our own sense of what school was to her. But it was frustrating for me because I think everyone always has a great deal of hope that your children are not even going to be as good as you are. They're going to be better. And because I'm in a business where intellect and all that sort of thing counts for a great deal, and it counts for a great deal of status that I enjoy, it was a big disappointment. And it was the biggest adjustment in the world was learning to accept Lynette as a person, and to even understand what she had to offer me as a person, which for a long time I fully did not understand. And I fully did not understand that child for a very long time because the learning disability got in the way. I mean, it prevented my being able to really appreciate her as a human being in many other ways because of that, because everything I did in relation to her was filtered through the learning disability.
When you thought that she just wasn't performing well before she was diagnosed with a learning disability, was it harder for you because, you know, she was going to a predominantly white school, you live in a predominantly white suburb, and here, like, your African-American child who's supposed to be a kind of great example of, you know, a kind of model African-American family and everything isn't performing well? Did you feel like she was just... that on this, like, larger level, it was going to reflect badly not only on the family, but on African-American intellectuals in general?
Yeah, I felt that burden terrifically. I mean, it's one of the things that my wife kept me sane about was that it was a crazy idea to feel that way. But I did because I felt in many ways that I live in a fishbowl. I'm a middle class black professional, and I live in a world mostly populated by whites. I work at a white university. I live in a white neighborhood. So you constantly feel that you're on display. Okay, you represent you represent the race. I mean, I was going around for a long time with this idea, even though I kept saying intellectually to myself, no, this isn't true. Emotionally, I kept saying, oh, I represent the race. And so as a result, I wound up putting a certain kind of pressure on myself. And certainly, I think it very much affected how I responded to Lynette, because then it was that you were responding to your child in front of, because your child was representing you in front of all these people. And it made me feel a certain kind of shame. And then it was exacerbated by the intense shame I felt about the shame that I felt. So
it was very
difficult. It took several years to be able to overcome that.
Well, before her diagnosis, you used to lecture her about race pride, about how she had to do better. How did she respond to those? Like, what would you say to her, and how would she respond?
Oh, I would say, black people have gone through a lot, so that we can be in this position today, and you can go to the school that you're going to and everything, and you have to work harder, and you have to, you know, because it's a very natural thing I learned once we began to learn about learning disability, that parents respond to it often with children by thinking the child is lazy and isn't working hard enough. So he said, you have to work harder. You know, you can't be seen as dumb in front of white people. You know, you just can't. How did she respond to these often? She would get angry and say, I'm tired of hearing this, you know. She would cry a lot of times. It was, she would keep saying to me, I'm working as hard as I can. I'm working. And the race thing, she just didn't understand that at all. That because it wasn't her experience. I mean, she didn't grow up with the baggage I grew up with. I mean, that wasn't her experience. She didn't. So that sort of stuff, she never. The appeal to race pride was meaningless. I mean, that was just me talking. That was like going completely over her head.
After Lynette's diagnosis, were you more comfortable knowing that it wasn't a question of underachieving? She had some kind of problem.
Yes. That made me feel more comfortable. That was also something I had to eventually overcome, was even that attitude. But yeah, that made me feel more comfortable.
My guest is Gerald Early. He's the head of the African American Studies Department at Washington University and the author of a new memoir called Daughters on Family and Fatherhood. Why don't we take a short break and then we'll talk some more?
Okay.
Okay, this is Fresh Air. My guest is Gerald Early. He's chair of the African American Studies Department at Washington University and author of a new memoir called Daughters on Family and Fatherhood, and he has two daughters. I want you to tell us about an incident that you describe in your memoir in which you were stopped by the police because a jeweler in a shopping mall thought that you were lurking around casing the joint. So the jeweler called the police, and the police came and got you. Your family was there, your wife and your children, and it was infuriating and embarrassing.
Yeah, that was some incident. My wife belongs to Junior League, and they were having this Christmas bazaar or something, and we went up there for that, and that's when this whole thing happened. And I remember when the police officer came to and asked me for identification, I was really upset. And I told him I was waiting for my wife and family to come out. And I could tell from the look on his face, he didn't believe that. He couldn't possibly believe that a black man would be in any way connected with the Junior League. I mean, he just thought I was talking crazy. Either he thought that it wasn't possible that if I'm married to a black woman, that she would be connected with the Junior League. Or I guess he didn't think it might be that I could be married to a white woman or something like that. I mean, it just never clicked with him at all. But that incident wound up becoming national news because of, in and of itself, it was would be considered a quite minor incident. But because it happened to me as a university professor and all that stuff, the newspapers in St. Louis got a hold of it, and then it blew up into a big story.
The experience nearly wrecked your relationship with your kids. How did it hurt that relationship?
Well, first, my kids didn't want to deal with it at all. I mean, they didn't want to.
They were embarrassed?
I don't know if they were embarrassed. My children, you know, they don't really like to talk about race a lot. You know, they feel as though in some ways it's a baggage that I want to put on them in a way that they don't want to deal with. This is not to say they don't understand certain realities about race in the world, but I think they would prefer, I guess, to want to understand it on their own terms, not on the terms that their father has come to understand it. But at any rate, it was a very, you know, it was a couple of week period that this whole thing happened. And it was a pretty stressful time because of all the publicity this thing got. And my oldest daughter in particular, she got ill. I mean, I think she was sick of going to school and hearing about it or something. But she was ill for a time and you know, just refused to talk about it. And I wanted to, I don't know, at the time, I just felt desperate that I wanted to talk to them about it and explain it to them. And I had this blow up, which I describe in the book with her, where I really just, I kind of just went crazy. I mean.
What happened?
Well, I started shouting to her about, I'm going to make you listen to this. You know, she's in bed. I'm standing over her. And I said, I'm going to make you listen to this. You know, you want to talk, you know, you don't want to deal with race. You think you're living out here in this la-la land with these white people and all this other stuff. And I want you to, you're going to hear me. You're going to listen to what I'm saying. She's saying, no, get out of here. Leave me alone. And I'm shouting at her, you know, I want you to understand what they did to me. You know, there's, you know, we see what happened. We tried to be striving black people. We tried to show people we were going to play by the rules and all that. You see what happens, you know, nothing ever changes. You know, it's always the same. It's always the same. So I'm going on like that. She's telling me to get out of the room. Her sister comes into the room, and her sister is telling me, leave Lynette alone, leave Lynette alone. And so I yell at her sister, shut up, get out of here, you know. And I really, you know, have lost control of myself. And then my wife came in, and she says, I think she said something to the effect, have you lost your mind? because I was really, I was screaming at Lynette. I pulled the blankets off the bed, and I remember I was pinching her skin. And I was saying, you see the color of this? This is the world. This is the reality of the world. And she's crying. And I just ran out of the room. And it was the most painful confrontation I had with my daughter, the most painful encounter I had with my daughter, with both of them, really. Especially with Lynette, it was very painful, and particularly the most painful thing probably since the battles with the LD. But I really felt I completely lost control of myself.
You know what this reminds me of? Like, parents who work all their lives so that their children can go to college. And so the parent works, oh, their children finally goes to college and goes to out-of-town college at that. And the child's kind of lost to them in a way because the child has been changed so much by this education.
Right.
You bring up your children in the suburbs in a middle-class life so different from your own upbringing. And their experience of reality is different than yours. They haven't been exposed to the racism you were exposed to, I guess. So I guess they find your vision of racism slightly incomprehensible because it's not...
Right.
You've brought them into a world where that's not their reality.
Exactly. And so all that yelling and shouting and everything, I mean, it didn't make much of an impact with Lynette, except she thought I had gone crazy, which I sort of had. I mean, she certainly didn't understand all this other raving that was going on. And, you know, it was very upsetting because it was something I had to learn from that about understanding my children on their own terms and understanding how they see their own lives and their own experience. And that was just another example of that my world that I grew up with is not the world of my children.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you for having me on.
Gerald Early is the director of African American Studies at Washington University. His new memoir is called Daughters, on Family and Fatherhood. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, what do you have on the possibility that we'll resume talks with North Korea?
Apparently, President Carter has found something to be hopeful about in North Korea, Terry, and we will take a look at that. We'll have several pieces on that issue, including one from the United Nations and a conversation with some people in Seoul about what people there are thinking. Also, the weather was terrible this winter, very, very cold. We're going to check back with some people who braved the cold weather and see how they're doing right now. Bob Garfield is looking into a serious issue in England: garden crime, bushjacking, fox fencing, purloining of petunias, and grabbing of gloxinias.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. David Byrne is still probably best known as a founding member of the band Talking Heads, but he's had a very diverse and prolific career, writing for film and theater, exhibiting his artwork, founding the music label Luwaka Bop, which specializes in another one of his passions, world music. Last year, Byrne did a number of acoustic performances and put together a smaller band. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of Byrne's new album. Here's the track, A Long Time Ago.
And in the land where I grew up, into the bosom of technology, I kept my feelings to myself until the perfect moment comes. Then into your bloodstream I will go until I turn flooding the garden of delights. That was a long, long time ago. That was a long, long time ago.
When David Byrne first came to prominence as the lead singer for Talking Heads, what immediately distinguished him from the general run of rock vocalists was his unearthly detachment. Back in the late 70s, Byrne's blank face and intentional monotone frequently made him seem like a robot, and it turned one of his creepiest songs, Psycho Killer, into one of Talking Head's first big crowd pleasers. Nothing in Byrne's early career was straightforward or, heaven forbid, personal. He avoided self-revelation. A decade and a half later, however, the most striking qualities of his new solo album, called David Byrne, are the directness of its emotions and the unironic warmth of the voice articulating them.
Some men desire a princess and others lust for a temptress. Well, I don't need one of those, 'cause my love is you. My love is you. Some men replace their mamas and some want a young boy out of nowhere. I got no use for those, 'cause my love is you. And my love is you. Sometimes they tell me I'm an asshole. Sometimes you're an asshole too. Even though we're filled with imperfections, I don't think any less of you.
On this collection, it's a decidedly reformed Psycho Killer who proclaims such sentiments as, "The pleasures of a kiss, it never fades away," and croons, "My love is you." Byrne has never sounded more earnest than on Sad Song, in which he solemnly says, "It's the truly sad people who get the most out of life." The album embodies a paradox, joyous melancholy. Byrne also makes buoyant music out of meditations on death, loneliness, and the remembrance of romance's past. Much of the album is Byrne's variation on the confessional conventions of singer-songwriter rock.
I met my love.
The best music on David Byrne transcends its singer-songwriter concept and reverts to Talking Head's best habit, that of using words as little more than sound while steadily intensifying the beat. In the past, Byrne created musical drama by being a terribly self-conscious artist, always struggling to loosen up. On David Byrne, the struggle is over, but the drama remains.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed David Byrne's new album, David Byrne. I'm Terry Gross.
The sun shines on the dead. Sun shines on you and me.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, we remember composer Henry Mancini with a 1987 interview. Mancini died this week of cancer. And we feature an interview with Dennis Hopper. He stars in the new thriller, Speed. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next archive edition of Fresh Air.